Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. It's Friday. A special hello to Paul. He's been on the Apple Podcasty thing and has posted a review. 5 stars, no less. Says, Matt's program is my choice of listening during the morning when I get the chance. But having a podcast with a columnist in the main feature makes up for missing the show. Consistently entertaining with the columnist and diverse on the features. Thanks, Paul. I couldn't agree more. Genuinely didn't write that myself. Coming up on today's episode of the podcast, everyone's talking about letters. Letters going into Graham Brady. How many letters are there? Are there 54? Have people taken their letters back? All of that. We're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about letters which have changed political history down the years, from letters to prime ministers trying to get them to change their policies, to Daniel Finkelstein's letter from Harold Wilson about watching the Muppets. Genuinely, it's great. That's coming up. First as ever, on a Friday, we kick off with our columnist panel, and it is Formel. It's James Forsyth and Melanie Reid. If people listening to this thought it was all going to be over soon, it was all going to come to a head and talk of Boris Johnson's future was going to be all done and dusted within a matter of days. James, you've got some bad news for them.
I think this is going to go on for quite some time. One Tory MP who has a kind of foot in both camps said to me that they think we're in for a kind of period of a few weeks of trench warfare between the rebels and the Johnson loyalists over whether you get to that 54 letters mark. I mean, my best estimate is that if the Grey report kind of lands where, you know, where number 10 have been suggesting to people it will land, that you'll probably get to about 40 letters. So that's a bit, you know, they'll be bobbing around that. Now, obviously, if it's worse, the number could go up. But I don't think this is going to be quick.
I suppose, you know, those, and I've sort of talked about this a bit before, but those of us who lived through the Theresa May debacle, we spent most of the summer of 2018 and into the autumn talking about letters. Jacob Rees-Mogg put in his letter and we thought, oh, that'll be it now. It was another month before there was a vote, which she won, and another 6 months before she finally left number 10.
Yeah, it's a long process, and it's worth remembering that you know, in November 2018, they were completely convinced that they had then it was 48 letters they needed. And it took another 3 weeks to actually get there because, you know, people say they put a letter in and they haven't, and all those kind of things, or someone else is persuaded to take their letter out. So I think this is going to be a drawn out process. I mean, there is a kind of question about where this lands. If you get to the confidence vote, then I think the dynamic is very different. That Theresa May vote, lots of people who didn't have any confidence in her voted for her because they had less confidence in what they perceived as being the alternative, which was, you know, Steve Baker and Jacob Rees-Mogg and a kind of and a harder Brexit.
Before I come to money, James, how significant do you think the Steve Baker intervention was yesterday? I mean, he's often been the sort of puppet master of Tory rebellions of one kind or another. You know, he did it with David Cameron over trying to get a EU referendum. He did it with Theresa May, as we were just discussing. Is that more problematic? You know, bluntly, Steve Baker is a smarter operator than Andrew Bridget. And if Steve Baker's now in the let's get Boris Johnson out camp, that's a worry for him, isn't it?
I read that Steve Baker quote as basically saying, I'm not going to do it, but don't let me stop you.
Very good, very good. Melanie, does your heart sing at the prospect of this dragging on for months?
It's quite extraordinary because while they're doing this, it's kind of all the navel-gazing and the disruption. You know, Labour are enjoying and prolonging it because the Tory brand is getting more and more contaminated. And the difference surely is this time is that there's a more credible leader in charge of the opposition. It was Corbyn when all this was going on, torturing Theresa May. It was Corbyn, and so there was no alternative. But now, if we're getting something like 98% of cut through on this whole thing, everyone knows about this now, and it's dragging on. They're going to start seeing in Keir Starmer someone slightly more credible to vote for. So it's a form of they're destroying themselves. It's a spectator sport. It's great. It's immensely good spectator sport. I mean, my carer comes in the morning and she comes bursting in saying, "Have you heard the latest about Boris Johnson?" Now, you know, this is extraordinary. It is
extraordinary. It's one of those. It's when the story has sort of proper cut through, when everyone is talking about it and following every twist and turn, when non-political friends are messaging me and saying what's going to happen, as if I know. On the subject of the Labour Party, my favourite, somebody sent me a message on Twitter this morning saying, wouldn't it be good to hear some serious politics from Labour rather than trying to bring down the government? And part of me thought, I mean, that's basically their job, isn't it, James? I mean, how do you think Labour are doing in handling this crisis?
I think Labour want to draw this crisis out for as long as possible. I think that, you know, considering how long Christian Wakeford had been in conversations with Labour, so kind of brilliantly detailed by Henry Zethman and Patrick Maguire in the Times the other day, it's quite clear that they essentially appear to have chosen the moment of his defection. And I think anyone who has been around Westminster know that political parties are tribal. So if someone walks out and defects, there is a kind of temporary rallying round of the ranks. And that is really what stopped the plotting, stone dead. Or you paused it, I think is the best way of putting it. And I think Labour knew that the defection would pause the plotting. And I mean, that is a sign that they want this to go on for as long as possible. You know, for Labour, the ideal world is that, you know, you have a no confidence vote, Boris Johnson wins it 52-48 and is determined to carry on. And, you know, you just have a Tory party that is paralysed by these tensions.
What do we make of Liz Truss standing shoulder to shoulder with the Prime Minister in Australia? Rishi Sunak's support, I think it's fair to say, has been tepid. Supporting Boris Johnson's call to wait for Sue Gray. What do you think, though, behind the scenes, are they ramping up for the possibility of a leadership contest, James? Because actually, you don't want to be seen to be doing it too publicly, but also there's, you know, if you leave it, you end up in a sort of David Miliband situation where others have overtaken you.
I think that kind of post the phone lines going in, there has always been a kind of hesitance on the Tory side to look like you're getting ready.
So I should explain, this is Michael Pertillo back in, which one was this, 95?
95.
Yeah, he started installing phone lines. Now you'd be caught, setting up a WhatsApp group called Pertillo for PM or something. But he was installing phone lines, and that made clear that he was preparing to start ringing round potential supporters.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that gave, you know, I think Boris Johnson probably would have won anyway in 2019, but one of the things that gave him an advantage was that because he was outside the government and because he was clearly at odds with Theresa May, you know, voting against her on Brexit on a regular basis, you know, he basically could lay down his kind of campaign infrastructure, start meeting MPs, all those things, you know, long in advance of a contest. I don't think you're going to see cabinet ministers doing that this time around because it is inherently risky.
What do you think, Melanie? Who's ahead, do you think, in your mind, in the potential, possible, not quite yet race to replace Boris Johnson?
I think in terms of being well known, I think Rishi Sunak, because of furlough. I mean, I think what he did and the kind of the glossy reputation he acquired through, you know, playing Father Christmas when we were all in lockdown, it was a wonderful role to have. And, it saved the bacon of millions of workers. And, you know, I think he still has the run on from that still that glow. It's not tarnished yet. I mean, you guys are in with the gossip and you hear, I mean, the sort of outsiders like, Tom Tuggenhat and people like this who, you know, who could well come racing in. But from the sort of the ordinary people's point of view, I think, Rishi Sunak has it at the moment.
It's an interesting question, though, isn't it, James? That in the past, you might have discounted the likes of Tom Tuggenhat on the basis that he's never been a minister, never mind being prime minister. But actually, you know, the bar for suitability for the job or proven track record may have been lowered somewhat by the past couple of years. So you sort of want, is the field wide open, or is it essentially, do you think, a race between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss?
I think it is very difficult to say I've never held any job in government and I would now like to be the Prime Minister. although set against that, I think, you know, there is obviously in the current circumstances, you can see an advantage from coming from outside the government. You know, that you know, you don't have to send out tweets saying, let's wait for Sue Gray. You can have slightly more distance. But I still think it is a stretch to imagine someone becoming prime minister who has not been a minister beforehand. I think if, you know, some of the people who like Jeremy Hunt, you know, talk him up on the basis that, you know, that he offers you kind of, you know, both of those options. He's not been in this government, but, you know, he's got extensive cabinet experience. But I still think it is probably likely to be someone from the current cabinet.
Well, we'll wait and see who exactly it is who starts installing phone lines. Just wanted to let's talk about. In fact, we got the. Let's play this again. This is the sort of thing that the government isn't going to remove.
This is Chorley.
That Grant Shapps, amid everything else which is going on in Britain today, Grant Shapps has declared war on annoying announcements on trains. Melanie, do you welcome this move?
Is this just the next thing on the Operation Red Meat? You know, the populist list.
I mean, I think if it is, it's not so much red meat as thin gruel.
I mean, what's next? You know, actors mumbling on TV or speed bumps. I mean, it's insane. You know,
One of the ones that he's. Grant Shapps has drawn attention on Twitter this morning is please put unwanted newspapers in the bin, which, I mean, it is annoying if you're on a train and there's just this relentless. I mean, I would go further and I would ban the chatty train guard who's, you know, welcoming everyone aboard. Hope you're very well. I'll be coming through the carriage. It's a sunny Friday morning. I remember one
Matt,
I remember one guard asking
guard, you would be the chattiest of train guards,
which is why it's probably a very good job that I'm not. I remember one I think he must have moved on to a different one now. He used to be on all the time, and he used to come on the PA system and ask a trivia question and then walk through the carriage asking people to shout out their answers. Oh God, give it away. Anyway, so you're pro the chatty train guard, are you, Josh?
No, I just think that, you know, sometimes position, you know.
You think that sometimes there's a place for it, but sometimes there's a place for it.
Well, it's nice to hear a real person rather than an announcement, isn't it? I mean, go ahead. I mean, I just love to, you know, it's nice to meet a train guard. I hear them in real life, so even if they are a bit sort of fond of their own voice. But it's the recorded ones can be a bit, yeah.
The worst are those Virgin Loos that talk to you.
Oh, God. Well, there's assault on all the senses as well, those Virgin toilets. I hadn't actually realised this. So I thought this was just like a bit of nonsense in the papers. But this is actually, they've put out a press release about it now. This does seem like, it's like a joke. Quieter trains are set to become the norm after the government announced will identify and remove repetitive and unnecessary onboard announcements on trains in England. Oh, sorry, Melanie. It's only in England. The changes mean that passengers will no longer be bombarded with unnecessary tannoy spam that distracts from important safety critical messaging. There's a review is going to be taken. It's going to last a year, the review, with redundant messages identified and starting to be removed in the coming months. Wow. The Rail Delivery Group is involved. There's acronyms and all. Banal announcements set to be culled include self-evident instructions, such as having your ticket ready when leaving the station, and contradictory calls for passengers to keep volume levels low while our onboard announcements blare out. It goes on and on and on. God, it's so long.
Is there any mention of toilets?
No mention of toilets. I think you're talking toilets. That might be. There might have to be the subject of a separate review. I'm afraid, Joe.
So we haven't got the Levelling Up white paper, but we have got this.
Yes. Or loo paper or whatever. Maybe those two things will come together. Before I let you go, we're talking about letters, because the letters being sent to Graham Brady, although we don't know how many there are. So we're talking later on about letters that have changed the course of political history. People have been sending in their best or worst letters they've ever been sent. Antonio says, when I was young, I received a letter from the actual Father Christmas just before Christmas. And I know it was genuine because my sister didn't get one and she was livid. James or Melanie, best or worst letter you've ever been sent?
Oh, James, you do it.
Oh, when I was about 9 or 10, I think, I entered a competition to find a kind of cricket commentator. And I got a very nice letter back from Test Match Special telling me that returning my tape and telling me I'd come fourth, which I was very pleased with.
That's nice.
Lovely. Yeah, and I got from a Times reader, I got a really lovely letter saying that my column had genuinely helped them come to terms with their life because of their disability. So I, to be equally... serious, I think you can get wonderful letters.
Oh, that's nice. I can honestly say nobody's ever said that my column has improved their life. James Forsyth and Melanie Reid there. You can read James in the Times on a Friday, Melanie in the Times magazine on a Saturday, where you can also read my column. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, letters which changed political history.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this. Yes, we're talking letters right now. Not the ins and outs of letters sent to Graham Brady, who, of course, is the chair of the 1922 committee. If he gets 54 letters through his letterbox, That will trigger a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson. But only, forget what anyone says, only one person knows how many letters Graham Brady's got, and that's Graham Brady, and he's currently on a long weekend away with his wife. So don't believe anything that anyone tells you. So what we thought we'd do, though, today is look at other letters which have changed the course of political history and what they can tell us about politics today. It's all inspired by a new project which has been set up by Dr. Kit Cowell from the King's College London. Morning, Kit.
Morning, Matt.
We've also got Professor Richard Toy from the University of Essex with us. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. Exeter, in fact.
What did I say?
Essex.
Oh, no, it says it does say Exeter in front of me. I'm just an idiot. I can't even read out loud, which is a good start when we're going to be talking about reading letters, so I do apologise. Yeah. University of Exeter. Of course, you've been. I think we've spoken to you before, Richard. Kit, explain for us, first of all, how this project has come about and what where you started when looking at political letters.
Yeah, so I actually started as part of a book that I'm writing about conservatism in the Second World War. And I found amongst Winston Churchill's papers a big chunk of files called condolence letters. And I couldn't really work out what this was going to be about, because to my knowledge, no one who Churchill really knew had died in the period I was looking at, which was just after the general election. And when I got that file out of the archive, lo and behold, it was full of hundreds and hundreds of letters from the general public and from MPs and well-wishers offering their condolence on Churchill's loss at the 1945 general election. So kind of intrigued by this, I kind of analysed those and started to think about what the history of these letters and different types of correspondence to politicians has been in Britain, and what that might tell us about political culture and people's understanding of politics and leaders before and after.
It's really interesting. It's a reminder that even when he lost the election, it doesn't mean 100% of people in Britain were pleased with that result, like, you know, with any election. I suppose if you're in your worst moments when you've just lost the general election, you know, that's gratitude for you after winning the war. He must have taken some comfort for that, for having decided to keep them.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, we don't know why these letters were kept rather than others. So he received thousands. The Conservative Party had to actually bring in kind of extra workers to go through them all. They had to set up a small incinerator to deal with all of the correspondence afterwards. And we've only got about 600 of the letters that were sent remaining. Whether or not he read all of them, we know that he certainly read some of them, and he replied directly to individual members of the public. And we have records certainly of his staff finding comfort and enjoyment from reading some of them too.
And Richard, this is just one example of lots, isn't it, that you've already uncovered of where the public have, in quite large numbers, quite often contacted political leaders for one reason or another.
That's right. I mean, I think there are lots of different motivations that people can have for wanting to write to an MP or a political leader. Sometimes it can be very instrumental if they've got a problem with their housing or some issue like that. That really, after 1918, in the era of mass enfranchisement, the role of MPs changed, so they were much more beginning to be expected to deal with these problems. Some MPs didn't want to do it. They didn't see their role as being a social worker, as some of them put it. But that's become a kind of essential part of an MP's job, detailed constituency work. And then, of course, people may write for quite other motivations. They may be seeking policy change, or, as in the letters to Churchill, they may simply be trying to express themselves emotionally, you know, to have established some kind of relationship or contact with somebody who might seem quite distant from ordinary people's lives.
And have you uncovered individual letters which have had such an impact that they have sort of changed the course of political history?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say that. I mean, certainly we have records from one of Lloyd George's advisors in 1918 at the end of the First World War, saying we're receiving thousands of letters about the need for reparations against Germany for the fact that, you know, that Kaiser should be put on trial. And in this kind of diary account, the advisor makes the claim that these letters were one of the things that influenced Lloyd George in his election campaign at the end of the First World War. How far that's true is something we're going to look into. But if it's the case, I mean, that's a really great example of the way in which a politician getting a sense of popular feeling directly through letters initiates a huge policy change with, incredible international and consequences.
It's really interesting that. And even things like the letters that Neville Chamberlain got praising from his response to the Munich crisis. You know, it's a reminder that in the heat of the moment, that it, you know, history takes a different view. But the heat of the moment, if you're getting lots of letters saying, we think you've done the right thing, thank you for trying to avoid a Second World War, then... you know, that's presumably interview influencing as well. I want to talk about Michael Foote and the... who knows best about the Michael Foote letters?
Kit, I think.
I think that's probably me.
Go on then, Kit. Tell us about the Michael Foote letters and vouchers.
So famously, in 1981, at the remembrance service held at the Cenotaph, Michael Foote was pictured not wearing kind of an elegant black dress coat, but a green coat that was referred to in the press as a donkey jacket. And this elicited a lot of howls of protest that he wasn't taking it seriously. Here's this kind of socialist not paying his proper respect. And his archives are full of letters from people sending him pennies, pounds, and even a voucher from M&S to go and buy himself a new coat. Why he kept these, we don't exactly know, but they certainly elicited quite a lot of laughs from us.
And so is the voucher still in the archive?
It's still in the archive.
So when unused.
And in fact, like, not only do people send letters to politicians, what we're finding is that in the archives, actually quite a lot of gifts still remain. There are kind of cigar cutters sent to Winston Churchill that are knocking around. There are flies for fishing stuck to letters that are in Neville Chamberlain's archives. A real treasure trove out there to be discovered.
When you talk about the archive, what are we talking about here? How is, because obviously Michael Foote was leader of the opposition, didn't become prime minister. There's not a sort of number 10 prime ministerial archive. How is it that you've managed to get your hands on a Marks and Spencer's voucher that was sent to Michael Foote to buy a new coat?
Well, that archive, that set of papers are at the People's History Museum in Manchester. We're very lucky to have papers like that. The collection of them is often down to the secretaries and back office staff that were working for these different politicians at the time. Sometimes these things were recorded for kind of posterity. Maybe they wanted to reply back to people, but often it was a case of just hanging on to what was there. So there's very much a kind of hit and miss approach that we're finding to collecting and retaining these letters that were sent.
But let's bring in Daniel Finkelstein, our very own Times columnist and regular here on the show. And Danny, the reason we've got you on is because you have a pretty substantial collection of letters from British prime ministers.
Yeah, British prime ministers and other prominent politicians, mainly prime ministers. One or two of them, I've only got things like warrants that they've signed or little messages. You know, Macmillan, I've got a message sent to one of his private secretaries thanking him for a draft note. But mainly they are substantial letters. At first, handwritten, and later typed.
And so who don't you have? Or have you got every prime minister?
Well, no, I haven't got Churchill. And the reason for that, I mean, really, you can really buy prime ministerial letters very cheaply. Robert Peel's letter to his son about some land deal they'd done, cheaper than Tommy Cooper's autograph, that.
How much, when you say cheap, do you mean like £5, £100?
No. In that particular case, that was particularly cheap. It was about £60. Okay. But £100, not very much at all. £100 is very standard. I mean, obviously, that is a lot of money. Considering the artifact, it's not very expensive. But the one that is expensive is Churchill. And so once I get to the point where I've collected everything else, I'll have to have a discussion with Nikki, my wife, about whether or not it constitutes an investment or a consumption good. I think my favourite of all the letters, weirdly, a very short letter, is just actually a couple of good ones.
Yeah, pick them out, because I've got copies of them as well, so I can see them in front of me. So
yeah, well, so I want to start with this one, which is Dear Ms. Gray, many thanks for your letter. I'm afraid that I receive many similar requests, but enclose an autographed cookbook, which I hope may be useful for your auction. With kind regards, yours sincerely, Jeremy Thorpe. And the reason why I find this a very interesting letter is that it was sent on the 27th of July, 1979. In other words, only just over a month after he was acquitted of conspiracy to murder at the Old Bailey, and was completely ruined. And this was from the NSPCC in Rainsford, in Merseyside. And you wonder why the NSPCC wanted to auction a Jeremy Thorpe cookbook 1 month after this trial. So that's one of my favourite ones.
I suppose at least it wasn't a sort of a guidebook, you know, to Dartmoor. I suppose that's the only way it could have possibly been worse.
Exactly. I suppose my favourite of all is this one from the 25th of January 1865. So just actually not very long before the gentleman involved in sending this letter died, and the gentleman being Palmerston. It's my dear Phipps, thank you for your answers about Forsyth. I'm glad you did not write to him, for I've found by experience that crazy people have a mania for letter writing, and answering their letters only encourages them. Yours sincerely, Palmerston. That, I think, is a pretty much of a universal.
That's a great letter.
I'm sure that Professor Toy, for example, will recognise that as a historical, both historically typical of Palmerston and of letters.
Well, I might say that, of course, it is true that you get many very eccentric letters in these collections. And some people will say, oh, well, you know, you can't put any weight on letters written to politicians because they are all written by crazy people. But I think that we're interested in, we're not necessarily thinking that these letters will be sort of representative of public opinion in some way, but rather that they tell us that we're interested in kind of marginalised people who may write crazy letters in green ink as well. And, you know, why did they then think that it would do some good in their, you know, sort of perhaps slightly crazy mental worldview? Why did they think that it was a good idea to write to Margaret Thatcher or Michael Foot or whoever?
Matt, I do think one of the things that is pretty interesting, and I would like to ask, you know, both our experts about this, quite a lot of letters that you would assume would be public property are simply privately available. You can buy on eBay. One of the examples that I've got is Mr. Chamberlain, with his humble duty to the King, has the honour to recommend that Sir Albert Charles Clawson, CBE, be sworn of Your Majesty's Most Honourable Privy Council on his appointment as Lord Justice of Appeal. Signed by Neville Chamberlain, approved by King George Rex Imperator, in other words, by George the Sixth and King and Emperor, on the 13th of January 1938. I was immensely surprised to find that at a fairly cheap price available to private collectors.
Well, I think that partly when letters have been sort of sent to ordinary members of the public, then of course they belong to that person. There may well be a copy in an official archive somewhere. Difficult to explain how a letter to the King, which maybe ought to have ended up in the Royal Archives, is available on eBay. But of course, it may be that we can't assume that sort of everybody's practices are around the office are really what they should be, and that sometimes you find that things get just binned or destroyed for no good reason. Sometimes they are thrown in the bin and somebody thinks, oh, well, this has got an important signature on it. I will, you know, pick it up and I'll sneak it out.
Yeah, that must be okay.
Just while you were talking there, Danny, I've hopped onto eBay. Obviously, other auction sites are available. And if you put in Prime Minister letter, I mean, you can get Lord John Russell, £20. Disraeli letter to Lord Derby on the Queen's speech, £50. Margaret Thatcher, £39.99. Benjamin Disraeli, £49.99. How can you be sure that what you're getting is genuine?
Well, some of them, you think you have to be quite a good person to imitate to know who Lord Derby is before you can imitate his signature. But you have to know what you'll do. Most of these, by the way, although they are for sale on eBay, I wouldn't buy them except from reputable dealers. There are a few people who are reputable dealers, and once you establish who they are, you should buy from them. And you might pay a small premium on doing that, but you know, I would not buy it from just a general source, because most of those would be fake. I just love, there are lots of letters turning people down for jobs that end up on eBay. So people end up with their relatives end up, they may not have somebody who was in the cabinet of the Earl of Derby, but they do have a £35 eBay artifact.
And what about, as I was mentioning, Kit, this issue of these days, everything's done electronically. You know, what was once, you know, particularly like the Palmerston, was it the Palmerston one, which is basically, you know, I'd be careful writing letters because it only encourages them. That is a letter. These days, that'd be a WhatsApp between friends. Is the death of letter writing depriving us of insight into what goes on in politics, do you think?
Yeah, quite possibly. Part of this is also down to worries about GDPR rules, and worries about the Freedom of Information Act. We know that politicians are quite wary about putting things down on paper these days, much more likely to actually go to old technologies, picking up the phone to kind of do the scheming that might have happened back and forth over correspondence of old. Because you know, that can't be requested by members of the public. So yeah, historians are very worried about what the future might hold and whether we're going to have the same kind of granular detail that we once had to kind of plot and trace the interactions of high politicians over the years. And then actually kind of looking into these kind of questions about who owns letters, who owns copyright behind them, the same with tweets and faxes and emails, some of the things that this project is going to do.
And Richard, the some of the examples of things that you're looking at actually go right up to quite recently. Like, you know, for instance, letters that were sent to Jeremy Corbyn that he read out at PMQs. And there's a brilliant story about letters sent to Gavin Williamson.
I don't know the Gavin Williamson story.
I thought it was he'd asked. I think it was on the on some notes about the project you were doing. He'd asked Gavin Williamson had asked parents to write to Ofsted to complain about online learning, and instead Ofsted received 5,000 letters of praise.
Yeah,
always a risk that sort of thing backfires.
Exactly, but I think it also shows sort of, you know, the instrumental nature of correspondence, so that. You know, people, it may look like a kind of a private act of writing a letter, which will then be sort of read by one person in an office. But in a way, these can be collective activities where people are encouraged, whether by a minister or by a campaign group, to write. You know, we probably all get emails which encourage us to email our MP about some particular urgent issue. And then, of course, MPs may be sceptical of what they think are kind of mass-generated letters or emails, and they'll be more inclined to take seriously ones which look like they are written sort of spontaneously, and therefore, you know, there is that, you know, sort of people are encouraged then to try and adapt their own message rather than just sort of cutting and pasting.
I tell you what, Matt, you know, that is... true the other way as well. I noticed that there was a certain point around the beginning of the 20th century where the letters being sent by prime ministers cease being ones that they've written themselves by hand and start being either typed. And the one that I noticed that I had bought a letter from Arthur Balfour. It was telling somebody that they were going to get a knighthood conferred by the king. And when I looked more closely, I realised he topped and tailed it, but actually the middle of it had been written by someone else. And that
someone else.
Yes, all the ones before that are handwritten by the prime ministers themselves, including Derby, for example, informing the head of Freshfield he wouldn't be appointed a justice minister or an attorney in the government. So he'd been writing even those kind of appointment rejection letters himself. And after Balfour's letter, almost all of them are typewritten that were just taking up Richard's point, going the other direction. And this is a sort of one on the cusp where the middle of it is handwritten, but not by Balfour. You wonder how on earth they coped with the correspondence. And you can imagine that the only way they did it was, as we discussed earlier, that there were these thousands of letters to Churchill. Clearly, there must have been a lot fewer at that time for prime ministers to be able to answer them by hand themselves.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing, the mass communication, even to the point that several people have been in touch with me and asked about the letters that you've been sent, letters from prime ministers. Obviously, every single person in the country got a letter from the prime minister. We were all told to stay at home. And lots of people have put them to one side and said, well, that's a piece of history. But I think there's one listed here for one of these Boris Johnson letters worth listed for £500 on eBay. I suppose the thing about Churchill, Danny's saying that the Churchill ones are the most expensive to get hold of. I mean, I suppose the thing that both Kit and Richard, you're finding is that there's so much of this produced, it's very difficult for it to have a value, a huge amount of value for a sort of historical insight, but not necessarily financial value, Kit.
Yeah, I mean, in certain cases, you actually have to kind of, more than thousands, tens of thousands, in the case of Enoch Powell, who, after his River of Blood speech in 1968, received over 100,000 letters from members of the public. So, yeah, putting a figure on that is very hard to do. But, I mean, it's wonderful that people can go out and buy these things, but it's also really helpful that they're in kind of professionally run archives that allow people like me and Richard to have a look at them.
And, of course...
I suppose if you actually went to the archives and tried a statistical analysis, you'd find the vast proportion of letters to modern politicians received the reply that the person was grateful for the invitation to come and speak to their audience, but couldn't make it. I've got several of those. I think those must be the most common of all political letters.
Danny, just on the subject of that, a letter that was sent to you from the office of Prime Minister rather than the Prime Minister himself. It's my favourite one, I think, in the ones that you sent over from the Harold Wilson's office.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. It was when I was a scout, I sent Harold Wilson a letter setting out a whole load of questions I wanted him to answer. They replied saying he didn't have time to answer them. And then a few days later, I got a letter addressed hilariously to Mr. David Finkelstein. It's from Marcia Williams. It contains a load of answers to questions. I can apply the questions from the answers. My favourite one, because I retrieved this during the time when Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the party, and obviously asked him which newspapers he read. And he said, "So Harold reads all the daily newspapers except the Morning Star." On the question of cars, he would probably buy any middle-sized British car. His favourite sport is golf, but he also likes to watch soccer. That ends the debate about, by the way, whether football should be soccer. He receives from between 500 to 1,000 letters a week. That's an interesting fact for our letter aficionados. And my favourite one is he does watch television, though he's usually too busy to do so in the evenings, but he likes feature programmes and the Muppets. So he'd obviously be quite enjoying 10 Downing Street at the moment. His favourite piece of music, Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony, the Hallelujah Chorus and the Emperor Concerto. An absolutely fantastic letter.
Yeah, absolutely. So
the great thing here is that Harold Wilson's letters are one of the collections that we're looking at. So you never know, Daniel, we might actually find your original copy in there.
Oh, that would be brilliant.
That's that would be terrific. Yeah, addressed to Dear David Finkelstein. That's absolutely terrific. It's been lovely to speak to you. It's such a fascinating project. I've been carried by Dr. Kit Cowell from King's College London and Professor Richard Toy from the University of Exeter. Thanks very much for taking us through that. And Danny Finkelstein, thank you for taking us through your collection of letters. We should be playing the Muppets ready. But anyway, that was Political Letters. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.